We have come in our study of Romans 9 to the focus that Paul has made on the vessels of mercy as a part of the divine plan to reveal himself in a greater degree of particular understanding of his glory. Paul has focused on the fact that he intended to demonstrate his wrath and to make his power known, but the power issue apparently in verse 23 is he might make known the wealth or the riches of his glory upon vessels of mercy. In our studies of chapter 9, we've seen a focus by Paul on two really large issues involved in understanding God's larger plan. And one is the issue of love, which the first paragraph of chapter 9 zeroes in on. And the other is its antithesis, which is hate, which the second paragraph kind of focuses on. And as we've worked our way into Paul's explanation, we've seen that the hate thesis is revealed by God's what we call irresistible will to reveal some things about himself that have to do with his attitude toward justice as it applies to behavior by men. And the myriad manifestations of that attitude as it's revealed in creation, because Romans 1:18 says that the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all manner of wickedness and stuff. Probably most people don't realize it's wrath. Most of us consider it a bad virus or whatever. But anyhow, it's clear that God considered the manifestation of his wrath to be a necessary evil in the sense that it irritated him because he had to endure with much patience the fact of the demonstration. But without it, as we said in the past, we wouldn't really have a very good grip on his love, because without wrath, what is love? We wouldn't have a very good grip on the sacrifice that Jesus made on Calvary, because without wrath, that's, you know. So there are just an awful lot of theological issues that are wrapped up in whether we have a good balance between the love and hate of God. That's the first two paragraphs. And then he wanted to make known by words, because that's the difference between demonstrating and making known. But he wanted to make known by words the issue of his attitude of love. And that's revealed by God's determination to focus on his attitude toward mercy and the multitude of words that are designed by him to make it known. There are many things about the love and the mercy of God that we flat wouldn't know by any kind of demonstration without the words. The words explain. And Paul says, by this we know the love of God, that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Without those words, we wouldn't have much of a grip on the love of God, because our grasp of who Christ was and why he had to die and all those kind of things would be meaningless to us. In fact, we wouldn't even pay any attention to it. With the words, the majority of humanity doesn't pay attention to it. So, the issue of making his mercy known is part of the issue in chapter 9, with kind of a little bit odd, to me at least, in respect to his declaration about mercy, because it's almost like verse 15, he says to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I'll have mercy, and I'll have compassion on whom I'll have compassion. It's almost like he's being accused of not behaving properly by showing mercy and compassion. He says, well, I'll do it if I want to. That's the kind of, I'm going to do this. If I choose to, I will. And it's a determination that indicates that he has a strong focus on mercy. And according to the text, the two bottom lines are wrath and power. I mean, that's what he wants to demonstrate, is wrath and his power. But they move backwards in a reverse order to love and hate. Wrath as a manifestation of his hatred towards sin, and power as a manifestation of his mercy because of his love. So those are the issues of the chapter so far. And as we've moved into Paul's argument, we've seen that underlying those issues of his glory are the issues of the methodology of relationship, because there are two systems involved in love and hate. In the methodological systems that are at work, on the hate side is the demand performance system, because on the hate side, where you have God despising sin and being filled with wrath against the ungodly and the wicked, you have these demands that the law makes. Demand, demand, demand. And it's the lack of performance of the demands that brings about the wrath. So in the wrath thesis, there is this system of thought, and the Jews had filled themselves up full with that mindset of the demand performance methodology, and it is a hate-driven methodology, because the Jews not only hated everybody that didn't perform like they wanted them to in the demand performance thing, but they hated the God who laid the demands on them, but they would never admit it. They claimed to love God, but they despised him, and it showed up as soon as he came in the flesh, in the person of his son Jesus, and they treated him like they treated him. And it was because of his message. So the issues of the methodological systems on that hate side is that demand performance thing, and on the mercy side or the love side is the promise faith system, where God makes certain commitments in words of promise, and all he requires of us to benefit from the words and the promises is that we believe him, depend on him to perform the thing that he said he would do. And these systems of demand performance and promise faith are just as antithetical in a very real sense to the originating issues of love and hate. So love produced a system called God making commitments and promises and asking us to believe him. And hate produced a system where you have this demand for the right kinds of behavior all the time, and then judgment based on the lack of performance of those demands. And that's why God ended up hating Esau, because Esau was outside the promise issue and his behavior was consistently rebellious and hateful, and God responded to the hate with hate. So we're actually past the vessels of wrath business in verse 23 to the vessels of mercy, and that's the issue of the love side of the whole equation, where God has prepared vessels of mercy for the powerful glory that he is going to fulfill words that have made it known in the future, and the blessedness that comes from being one of the vessels of mercy. So we've come to this evening the issue of his validation of the vessels of mercy, because he said in verses 24, 25, and 26, he prepared these vessels of mercy, and he says, us, whom he also called, not from among Jews only, but also from among Gentiles, as he also says in Hosea, I will call those who are not my people, my people, and her who is not beloved, beloved. And it will be in the place where it was said to them, you're not my people. There they shall be called sons of the living God. So Paul in these three verses is validating his vessels of mercy thesis with an identification of who are the vessels of mercy. And he claims that they are the called who come from among both Jew and Gentile. And he validates it by quoting from Hosea, which is kind of an interesting quote. We'll get to that in a little bit. But the particular issue that he is trying to focus on, especially in the phrase of verse 24, not from among Jews only, but also from among the Gentiles, is because in the hate system that the Jews had fully filled up themselves with, in the focus on justice and judgment and condemnation of everybody that did anything wrong, there were several things that came out of that. One of them was immediately a blindness of pride, where because they did some of the things they were commanded, they would highlight their obedience and get proud of themselves, and then they would condemn everybody that wasn't as obedient as they were, and they ignored all of those areas where they didn't do what they were told, and they were completely blind to that. And when Jesus came on the scene and started making them aware of it, they hated him. So that's why it's the hate side of it. But in the culture of Judaism, the vessels of wrath were Gentiles, and the vessels of mercy were the Jews. And they were rooted in the Jewish mentality of the demand performance methodology, because their whole focus was on the holiness and justice of God. And if you want to get along with God, you had to do what he told you. So in Paul's gospel, which was a reason for them to hate him. There's no recognition of an automatic bias in God on the basis of how men produce works of righteousness. He doesn't have a bias toward men on the basis of their production, because for Paul, number one, there are none righteous, not even one. And number two, on the basis of law, no one will be justified. Paul said in chapter 3, by the law shall no flesh be justified. Period. That means none. Not from Adam till now has anybody ever been justified by the works of the law. If everyone really believed that, it would make a huge difference theologically. We've even got some dispensationalists who used to teach that in the Old Testament you're justified by obedience to the law. And it was like Paul never wrote Romans 3. I mean, it's like, what part of by the law shall no flesh be justified did you not get? But nonetheless, they didn't get it. And that's a part, again, of this whole issue of man's blindness that is rooted in his own pride. But in Paul's gospel, he sets about to establish the larger plan as rooted in mercy. And it's expressed by words. It's made known by words that are intended to be believed. It's not words that you're going to immediately experience the reality of. The glory that is promised in the words of the promised faith methodology is always presented in the scripture as vastly majority future. There are some things. Paul talked in Romans 8, for example, about how we receive the Spirit as the initiation. We have the Spirit, but there are all these other issues that are involved. And so he's kind of like the first fruits, but not anywhere like the real harvest. And that's not a denigration of the Spirit, but the fact is, the presence of the Spirit of God in the lives of people is not anywhere close to what the glory is going to be like once the glory has come. And so it's a future thing, and it requires that we believe the words. And it's focused on mercy. So in this chapter, he talked about, verse 16, how it doesn't depend on man who wills or man who runs, but on the mercy showing God, or the mercy expressing God. His focus is on God's intention to show mercy. He is going to do this. And for our Jewish mindset, mercy was just an empty word. It was very much like the Islamic mantra, Allah the Merciful. They say that all the time. But in Islam, there is no mercy. Even in their attitude about, I mean, there's a sense of mercy in the fact that if you are merciful to the down and outers, if you give alms and all that kind of stuff, you can make points with God, with Allah, by being merciful. But the fact is, even Allah isn't impressed by your mercifulness, and he's not going to be merciful to you either. He's going to measure all of your behavior and give you what you've got coming. And the only hope that Muslims have for actually entering into their eternal blessedness is if they die a martyr's death for Allah's sake. I mean, that's the only guarantee they have. If you die as a martyr fighting a holy war for Allah, then you automatically get to go to heaven. But anybody else, you got to stand before the judgment of the merciless God, who you say all the time is merciful, but it's an empty word. And that's exactly the same attitude the Jews had. The Jews' fixation on performance and obedience and righteous behavior created supercritical attitudes on their part and anger toward God. And they talked about God being merciful, but it didn't mean anything because he really wasn't. So that's one of the things I want us to start out by thinking about in terms of the identifying characteristic of the vessels of mercy. He says that he's making known the wealth of his glory upon vessels of mercy. And then in verse 24, he says, even us. So then he goes into an explanation of who the vessels of mercy are. But in the characterization, the first thing that we have to be aware of is that we're called vessels of mercy. That's the first thing that characterizes these vessels. They are recipients of mercy. And the insertion of mercy is a major development in the theological setting in Matthew's gospel, because in Matthew 9:13, Jesus and some of the hard-headed legalists of his day were in conflict, and he told them, "Go and learn what this means. I do not desire sacrifice, but mercy." And they went and did not learn what that meant, because in chapter 12, verse 7, he says, "If you had learned what it means, I don't desire sacrifice, but mercy, you would not have condemned the righteous." So he told them to go learn it, but they didn't. They assumed they already knew about the mercy. But they didn't. There was no mercy in their hearts, and there was no mercy. In fact, one of the characterizations of lost people outside of Christ is that they're merciless. So these Jews, no matter how religious they were in their system, had actually justified their mercilessness by the rationale that people are getting just exactly what they deserve because God's just and they deserve it, so they're going to get it. But I'm not because I tithe and I do, you know. And that's one of the issues, because in the context of Matthew 9, where he says, "Go learn what this means," he said, "Because I didn't come to call the righteous to repentance, but sinners." So mercy was designed for sinners. It was designed to address sinners. And the Jews were constantly on Jesus' back. "Why do you eat with those kind of people?" And the kind of people they were talking about were sinners, as if they weren't. And Jesus just kind of in a subtle way just said, "Well, I didn't come to call the righteous. I came to call sinners." And yet that's what he meant when he said, "Go learn what this means." Mercy is addressed to sinners. And in the legal theology of Judaism, mercy takes an extreme backseat position. It's an empty word. So that's the first thing that we have to realize when Paul says that God is making known or explaining in words the wealth of his glory upon vessels of mercy. He's talking about being good to sinners. And then he identifies them as us. Verse 24. "Us whom he also called." So this is the second issue in the description or the characterization of the vessels of mercy. They're people who have been called. He has used this calling issue in this context with a couple of precursors that I think are crucial. In chapter 9, in the near context, he says in verse 8, "It's not the children of the flesh who are children of God, but the children of the promise. Because this is the word of promise, at this time I'll come and Sarah will have a son. And not only this, but there was also Rebekah when she had conceived twins, though the twins had not yet been born and had done nothing good or bad, in order that God's purpose according to choice might stand, not because of works, but because of him who calls." So the called are the ones who are identified. Isaac was called by God into existence because God had made a promise and Abraham had believed it and Sarah believed it. And so God called the son into existence as the fulfillment of the promise. Well, Rebekah was barren and she got on her husband's case and he said, "I'm not God." But he prayed for her and she conceived, but she conceived twins. So before they were ever born, God just informed her, "Look, this way it's going to work out. The elder's going to serve the younger, or the stronger is going to serve the weaker. This is the way it's going to be." And he calls that an expression of promise that is to be believed. And he then calls the issues of the promise into existence. And that falls back on chapter 4 in Romans, where Paul says Abraham's greatest spiritual lesson. He didn't say it exactly this way, but he was talking about Abraham learning finally that he believed in a God who called the things that are not as though they are. And in the issue of calling in Romans 8, which we'll get to in just a minute, he actually says things about us that are technically true, but experientially not. He calls us righteous. He calls us saints. He calls us sinless in chapter 7. And in a technical sense, those things are all true. But in the actual practical outworking sense of day-by-day living, we got a long way to go to live up to our calling. But the fact is, he says that he is calling these. They're the called. In Romans 8, which is a little further back, but it's still in the close enough context, he says in verse 28, we know that God causes all things to work together for good for those who love God, to those who are called according to purpose. So this issue of God having this large purpose in mind, and the purpose in mind is to create a scenario where life is possible for people who believe his pronouncements as well as reason properly about his demonstration. Life is what he's trying to produce, and in order to produce it, he's got to reveal things about himself, something about everything that's true about himself in terms of attributes, so that life can be a full orb thing. It can be rich because every one of those attributes is infinite. So if you learn what the attributes of God are and recognize how they fit into your own experience in life, then you can just chase those forever and you'll never come to the end of them, because that's the riches of his glory. But the fact is, it has to start with God having a plan and deciding, I'm going to fulfill this, and those who believe my promises are going to be the ones who participate in it, and we call those the called. Because in Romans 8, it says that he predestined, and then he called, and then he justified, and then he glorified. And of course, the predestination, we work way back to the beginning of time. The calling is an actual historical event in every individual's life in a particular point in time. The justification happens when that calling is actually responded to by the person by faith, so that they're justified by faith. And then it says he's glorified them, but that's the same kind of thing that he said in chapter 9 when he said he prepared them beforehand for glory. The glorification is the fulfillment of the promise of this wealth of glory that's to come. So this is the second characteristic, that they are us whom he called. And I don't know about you, but I marvel at my salvation history. I know what I was like as a junior and senior in high school, and I know how absolutely deaf to spiritual reality I was. And even though, you know, Jerry's girlfriend's mom always loaded us up and took us to the Baptist revivals to fill the pew night, pack the pew, and I'd sit there and listen to the evangelist and I'd feel guilty and all that, but right over the top of my head. And I remember one conversation where Jerry's girlfriend said, I have this most fantastic news. And I said, what? She said, my brother got saved last night. And I said, oh. And she says, well, you don't act very excited. Well, what was there to be excited about? I don't know what she's talking about. I mean, I know where I was then, and I marvel that God gave me a life, a whole life. I mean, after he called me and gave me understanding and I believed him, my life took on a direction and purpose and stuff that I had never given a thought to. And looking back on it, I wouldn't have changed it if I could, if I had known what it would be like. Because there's life in this thing. And without his interrupting my life, inserting himself by calling me, I would have just been lost as a goose and lived whatever kind of life would have happened that way, and I'd be just as hopeless as everybody else that has no hope. So I marvel at that. But he calls us those whom God called. We are the vessels of mercy. And then he deliberately says, well, before I say that, let me just say this. In chapter 9, verses 9 through 11, he said that Rebekah had these twins, and before they had done anything, God's purpose according to choice might stand, not because of works, but because of him who calls. That's reemphasized in verse 16, where he says it doesn't depend on the man who wills or the man who runs, but on God who has mercy. And the reasons for that are the facts about man's dominion under sin. He is so dominated by sin, he's blind as a bat, doesn't understand anything about living, is totally self-centered in all of his pursuits, doesn't have a care in the world for any kind of true righteousness or any of that kind of thing. And if it weren't for the mercy of God and his determined manifestation of I will show mercy to whom I'll show mercy, there would be nobody saved. They were talking in Sunday school this morning about people who really diligently seek God, so God responds to their search and gives them the light of the gospel and brings them to the saving knowledge of Christ. And I thought, yeah, there's some truth to that, because God, the Holy Spirit, does place in us a desire to know God. And then He fosters that desire in us so that we actually have a desire to be forgiven and all that. But the focus of attention in the conversation this morning seemed to be on us coming up with this desire. I didn't generate this desire to be right with God or to walk in the light or any of that kind of thing. I didn't have any interest in that. I just wanted my life to run the way I wanted it to run, like everybody else does. So when we talk about Paul's focus on the calling, we're not talking about God excluding. We're talking about God including, because He's determined to show mercy so that people who recognize His mercy can get to know Him better. That's the whole idea. So that He calls us vessels of mercy. He calls us the called. And then He says that they're not from among Jews only, but also from among Gentiles. And this is a direct declaration on Paul's part that the Jews' racial theology, where the blessing of God comes on the genetic descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, just ignores and leaves out the Gentiles. Unless, of course, they decide to become Jews in practice through the proselytizing efforts of certain of the Jews. I mean, there were people like the Ethiopian eunuch. He was an Ethiopian, he wasn't a Jew. But he had gone up to Jerusalem because he was a proselyte to the faith. And this whole idea that the Gentiles basically were vessels of wrath, but on occasion, if, you know, a Gentile really wanted to know God and wanted to become a Jew and practice the law, then God would accept him because of his desire to do what's right and all that kind of thing. Well, Paul is directly contradicting that notion that it's just the Jews who are the vessels of mercy, and the Gentiles, might a few of them might get in if, you know, if they respond properly to the Jewish proselytizing efforts. Because the Jews had it firmly fixed in their brains that in order to be saved, you had to be of the seed of Abraham. We are Abraham's seed, they said to Jesus. And He said, no, you're not. You're the seed of the devil. You're trying to kill me, and Abraham didn't try to do that. You're not following Abraham's example, either in behavior or faith. You're following the lust of your father, and the deeds of your father you'll do. And he was the murderer from the beginning, and that's why you're trying to kill me. And of course, they went into a fit over that, because, oh, we're not trying to... Yeah, you are. But, you know, talking to a legalist is like talking to that wall right over there. It just doesn't do any good at all. And it's proven in the history, early history of the church. As late as Acts 15, 16 years after the church was founded on the doctrine of justification by grace through faith, 16 years after that, there's still a body of people in the visible church in Jerusalem saying, if you want to be saved as a Gentile, you have got to obey the law of Moses and become in practice, basically, a Jew. That heresy, and it's a rank heresy, was tolerated in the church in Jerusalem for 16 years. There were apostles like John and Peter and James and those guys who should have known better, but I don't know what was going on in terms of the conflict of developing a theology. Jesus had worked with most of these guys for about 7 years, but most of what He said just went right over the tops of their heads. They didn't seem to have learned much of anything by the time He got to the cross. But then the Holy Spirit came on the day of Pentecost, and Jesus had said, when He comes, He'll remind you of the stuff I've told you, so then it'll make a difference. But it didn't clarify the gospel in the church in Jerusalem. So, in Galatians 2, God tells Paul to go to Jerusalem and get this thing squared away. So, in AD 49, he goes up to Jerusalem and confronts that heresy. and he carries the day with his arguments. And it's James and Peter, the two most waffling of the ones that are in leadership, that stand up first and say, Paul's right. This is the gospel. This is the truth. But the only way that kind of stuff could have lasted in the church in Jerusalem for that 16-year period was if there was such an ingrained notion that you had to be connected to Abraham by genetics to have any real security in your salvation hopes. That was so much a part of the Jewish mindset that it was just really hard for even the saved Jews, it was really hard for them to jettison that. But in the economy of God, he worked it out. So Paul went up there, made that the issue, and gave them the information through Paul that they needed to know in order to make a good, solid decision theologically. Yeah, the gospel is, you're saved by grace through faith in Christ. You're not saved by any performance of any work of the law of any kind. And it doesn't matter if you're a Jew or a Gentile. See, they'd had that argument a little earlier when Peter went to Cornelius' house, and then they jumped his case when he came back to Jerusalem. Why are you doing it in that Gentile's house? He said, well, let me tell you the story. And so he told them how God had led him to do that and how the Spirit fell on the Gentiles while he was preaching the gospel. And they sat down and said, okay, well, I guess that means that God's opened the door to the Gentiles. So the idea that Gentiles could be involved was settled by the Cornelius Peter thing, but the fact that they still wanted these Gentiles to become practicing Jews hadn't settled the big theological issue of just exactly how are you justified before God? By faith or by something you do? And so that was settled. And it completely, that first church council is the way they call it in church history, but that Acts 15 event actually destroyed the demand performance theology of the Jews. Set it completely aside. It didn't destroy it in the hearts of the Jews. It didn't destroy it in the practice of the Jews. It didn't destroy it in the aggressiveness of the Jews against Paul and his gospel. But in terms of actual, accurate theology, it was destroyed at that point. And then, the third thing Paul does in the text is he says, this is what Hosea was saying. Not from among Jews only, but also from among Gentiles. This is what Hosea was saying. But it's interesting. In Hosea chapter 2, verse 23, you have this quote, I will call those who were not my people, my people, and her who was not beloved, I'll call beloved. And then in Hosea 1, 10, verse 26 says, it shall be that in the very place where it was said to them, you are not my people, there they shall be called the sons of the living God. Now, Paul is saying that this proves that it's not just Jews, but also Gentiles who are called by God into this vessels of mercy identity where they can experience the life of God because of the mercy of God. But when you go back and read Hosea, Hosea's text in chapter 1, verse 10, which is quoted in verse 26, and chapter 2, verse 23, which is quoted in verse 25, both of those texts actually have a direct interpretive application to Israel, who had abandoned God and had been hauled into captivity by the Assyrians. And God said of Israel, the 10 tribes, you're not my people, and you're not my beloved. And then he said to Hosea, there would come a time when he would call those that he had said, not my people, he would call them my people. And to those that he had said, you're not my beloved, he would call my beloved. And the same thing is true in verse 26, which quotes from chapter 1, verse 10. In the very place it was said to them, you're not my people, he's talking about Israel. You're not my people. You have abandoned me. You have forsaken my rule over you, So you really don't see in Hosea 1 or 2 any clear-cut statement that this includes Gentiles. And yet, Paul says in verse 24 that it's not from among Jews only, but also from among Gentiles, as he says in Hosea. So the question is, well, how did he say that? And I believe that the answer is an answer that comes straight out of the science of hermeneutics. That's how you interpret. And in the science of hermeneutics, there is this reality called type of meaning. And we've talked a little bit about this in the past. But that's how we identify things. We have certain characteristics, and we put those together and call it this. So, for example, the word tree is a type of meaning. And any time that all the elements that constitute tree are in place, that type of meaning is there. So it doesn't matter if it's a pine tree or an oak tree or a, you know, whatever kind of tree you're talking about. It doesn't matter the specifics as long as the basic issues are there. And you can distinguish a tree as a type of meaning from a bush as a type of meaning because of the difference in the characteristics. And this type of meaning thing means that when God said to Israel, the ten tribes that had been, they had never been faithful since they split off from Solomon's kingdom, he said to them, "You are not my people." Well, in effect, that's what he had said to the Gentiles at Babel. "You are not my people." It's the same type of meaning. That they were descendants of physical Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob beside the point. The characteristics of the offspring of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in this text is called a characteristic called promise faith. And these people had never exercised that kind of faith. So they could call themselves the seed of Abraham if they wanted to, but they were not. They were the children of the devil. That's what Jesus said. So in terms of type of meaning, they fit the type of meaning Gentile. Because the Gentiles were notorious for worshiping other gods and not yielding to the identity of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They didn't believe God's promises. They didn't respond to the truth about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They were not God's people. They rejected him as a God, as their God. And so the whole point here is that it's true for both the Jewish descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. When God said, "You're not my people," he said, "That's not going to be permanent. I'm going to call them my people." And when he said, "You're not my beloved," that's going to change. "I'm going to call you beloved." Which basically means he's going to do a work in the ten tribes to bring some of those people into this promised faith thing. And he said, in the very place where it was said to them, "You're not my people," they will be called the sons of the living God. But because the type of meaning there is that God is making this distinction between people who are his people and who are not, that distinction was not racial. It was the difference between demand performance and a promised faith. And because it wasn't racial, but based on promised faith or demand performance, because that was the issue, all the Gentiles were included in that type of meaning in terms of the development of demand performance. Because as long as the promises are not met by faith, we are under this demand performance thing, and God's demands require our performance, and if we don't give it, we will be held accountable at the great white throne judgment, and the judgment will be, "You didn't perform like I told you to." So, justice requires that you pay the penalty for that, and he's going to cast them into the lake of fire. So in terms of type of meaning, it's true that Hosea's basic focus in the text was between Judah and Israel. Judah was the people and Israel was not. Judah was the beloved and Israel was not. But God says, that's all going to change because I'm going to call them. And I'm going to call them my people. And I'm going to call them beloved. And I'm going to call them the sons of the living God. And the fact that that reaches out to anybody that would be categorized as not my people or not beloved, or, well, those are the two issues, not my people or not beloved. Anybody who fit that type of meaning would be included. And that's the only rationale I can figure out would apply to Paul's argument that this actually included Gentiles. Because the text of Hosea, there is no clear indication that this is addressed about Gentiles. It's about Israel. But that's my explanation for why he can say, Hosea said this. It's not just Jews, it's Gentiles too. In other words, it's not based on race. It's not based on genetic heritage. It's based on whether you're not one of the people of God, not beloved by God. I'm going to call some of those called vessels of mercy, my people, my beloved, the sons of the living God. And that's probably why in chapter 9, God is pretty upfront about saying, I'll show mercy on whom I want to show mercy. Nobody can tell me it's not right for me to be merciful. It's interesting that he takes the issue of my people, beloved, and sons of the living God. Those are the three things he promises the vessels of mercy will be. And it's significant that he used the word sons instead of children in verse 26. He is actually underwriting their growth into maturity as his children so that they become his sons. He's got some things to say about what Isaiah says about Israel itself. He says concerning Israel and so on. But we'll get to that